Thanks for listening to RTÉ Radio 1's The Rolling Wave podcast with me, Aoife Cormick. In this episode, we'll be hearing about the life and music of the Sliabh Lochra fiddle player, Julia Clifford.
There's a black and white image of Julia playing her straw fiddle where she's wearing, you know, a geometric print dress, and she's the permed hair. She's actually holding the straw fiddle in her hand, and as it happens, she's looking at the camera as though she's been taken by surprise, you know. And it's a very striking image. And I remember seeing that quite early on, and that captured my imagination as well, as it would everyone's imagination. You couldn't help but be drawn into that, to that image and that photograph, you know.
She was a very likeable person, very, very sociable person. She loved the company of people, you know. And of course, like, the music was the magic that she had.
I recall in particular at the Cornwall Folk Festival, entering this like a festival club type of place in a large pub, and Julia was almost like a queen sitting in the middle of a large group of people, hippies sitting on the floor, cross-legged, some with instruments, some without instruments, sitting, listening to Julia playing this funny fangled instrument. Of course, the straw fiddle is what it was. And I remarked to myself, that is so far removed from the picture that might be painted in Dan Connell's pub in Knocknagree. But nonetheless, it was another side of Julia's persona and life, if you like.
And she took that in her stride, did she, completely?
Totally.
Clifford was born in Lisheen, Gonivguilla, County Kerry in June 1914. She was the youngest of nine children, and she was born and brought up with music. Her father, Bill the Weaver, or the Waver, was a flute player, and her mother, Mainie, sang. Julia and her brother, Dennis Murphy, were to become the best known musicians of the family, but all the children played, and there were always three or four fiddles lying around the place. So when it came to Julia's turn, there was no shortage of teachers in the house, as she explained in an interview with Peter Brown.
Who would have taught you now, your brothers and your father?
My father started me, and my brothers that gave me the first tune. My brother that gave me the first tune. Half a tune, really. And I learned away there from that. And my father taught me then. And then I was playing away, you know, not too bad. And I won this prize. Somebody suggested I should have a teacher. This old Gordy said I should have a teacher. So Padraig was the only teacher around the locality. So they brought Padraig in.
Padraig O'Keefe.
And Padraig started me from there. Padraig O'Keefe.
Can you remember that first, that half a tune that you did
now? I can.
Would you give us a bit of it?
Yeah. The Ducks and the Oats.
Thank you. Do you remember?
I don't think I've played it since.
No.
Padraig O'Keefe, the great Slievelúchra fiddle master, was a gifted teacher and musician, but he was an unpredictable character as well, and he kept unusual teaching hours.
But he never come to me until late at night.
Is that so?
Until the pubs were closed.
On his way home.
On his way home, he come late. Now, sometimes we've gone to bed, and I get up, and he played tune for me, and he played it so well that it used to enter into my head. And I couldn't forget it. And I played directly after him.
Right.
And he used to say there was no point in writing music for me because I had to pick it up so quick.
The tradition of music and music teaching stretched back a lot further than Padraig O'Keefe and Slievelúchra. There was Tom Billy, a blind fiddle teacher who most likely gave Padraig a lot of his music. And then there were many others, people like Danny O'Keefe or Danny Abb. And again, Julia remembered him clearly.
Danny Abb, a bit of a farmer, but he never worked in the farm. But he used to travel around a bit. And this Sunday, we didn't know him very well, but he was full of music. It was on a Sunday morning, and we weren't at mass anyway, I don't know where everybody else was. So he came in, he came up through the fields, and he came in. Myself and Dennis were in. So he says to Dennis, "Will you make the tea?" He says, "I lend you a couple of slides," he says, if you make the tea. But God, Dennis wasn't long going for the kettle, I needn't tell him. And we gave him plenty of tea. And he gave us two slides. I'll plant them.
Lovely, Julia. Those have become very popular, those tunes.
Yeah. I live in Norfolk in England. I come home twice a year. And I was shopping over in my local village. And there was a couple of buskers. And they were playing that tune. I told them, I said, it's come a long way.
Alan Ward, in his booklet The Music of Slievelúchra, writes that Julia was Padraig's favourite pupil, that she began learning from him from a very young age and so was very deeply influenced by him. But there's definitely no doubt that the fiddle came easily to her and that she liked playing it, so much so that when she was about 14 she snuck out to take part in a competition being run by a man called Gordy. He hosted hugely popular travelling shows which included comedians, singers, raffles and that fiddle competition.
The place is packed. Place is packed.
That's it.
It's packed.
You remember Gordy, don't you?
Of course.
And he raffled everything. He raffled a pig one night. He raffled a pig. All the farmers were in there.
And he did a fiddle competition one time and you went in for it.
I went in for it and all the local musicians around the place weren't in for it as well. I was only about, I don't know, was I 14? That was as much as I was anyway. I was going to school. I wasn't even supposed to be there. I think my father and mother didn't know I was there. I stole there. And they used to have, there was teachers and everything went in for it. The prize was, I don't know, was it 10 shillings? It was a lot of money then, you know. A brother-in-law of my sister's asked me to go up on the stage and I was afraid in case they'd know at home I was at the concert. So he said, you go up, he says. And I remember him lifting me up in a plank. And I had to walk a plank to get up on the stage. The crowd was so much. And I played two or three tunes. It went on, of course, then for two or three nights, the semi-final and the final.
And who did you...
I won it.
Who did you beat in the final?
Morris Rean and Auchmagree. I forget.
Dead Willies.
I forget. I think Dennis played. I think Dennis played.
So you would have come first in front of Dennis?
Yeah, I did.
Dennis played a lot of music together and with Padraig O'Keefe right through their teenage years, travelling to house dances and all kinds of gatherings and then later on the dance halls. But like a lot of Irish people of the time, she was destined to go away looking for work. And when she was 18, she was sent to Scotland to train to be a nurse. But that first trip away didn't go so well, as she explained to Matt Cranitch in this interview from 1994.
And the nursing didn't... appeared to
you
all that
no,
well.
I didn't like it in mental hospital. Yeah. And I didn't like it at all. Yeah. I stayed there for 12 months and came home. Christmas came and I got lonesome when I came home. The music used to draw me home.
So she stayed at home then for about another year before heading off again, this time to London, the place which would become her home for many years, and this time she worked in hotels.
I went over to London. I worked in the Savoy Hotel in the Strand and Park Lane Hotel, very big posh hotels. I worked there, got great tips.
Were you playing then by night as well, you were?
I wasn't then, until I got married. We played by night then. We played in the dance halls, myself and John. We played in the dance halls in Cricklewood. We were 14 years in Cricklewood. And we played in the pubs. When the dance hall broke up, we played in the pubs.
Then my father and John Clifford came on the scene then, and they met during this time when she was working at the hotels, and they got married then around 1939.
So they lived together in England then for those early war years.
They lived in London then, and they played music together. My father played the accordion, the button key accordion, in those early days, the two row accordion, and they got work in. There was no work, there was no music in the pubs in those days, Aoife, you know. That was much later on. So they got playing in dance halls then.
Did she ever talk to you about those early years in London, about living through those war years and everything?
And only the end of the kind of obvious things like running it, and the most when the plane, the Nazi plane's coming over, and you know the sirens are going off, and we all dive in for the shelters, you know. Those ones she mentioned those a few times, you know.
There was two halls there, an upstairs and a downstairs. The upstairs was for modern dancing, and the downstairs was for Cayley. And we played in the Cayley hall. Then the hall broke off. Joseph Locke came to the opposite hall and closed our place. All the crowd went there, and we were out of work. So we played in the pubs.
But when you were playing for the dance, for the Cayley dancing, was John and yourself was in the band?
John and myself and Mick Nash, Johnny Egan and Benny. Yeah. But there used to be a few odd quick steps as well in there, and they played them. Yeah. Mick Nash was mostly a modern player. But we used to play for the City of Venice and the sets.
And did they have set dancing after?
They did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Polka sets.
Uh-huh. Polka sets.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, the Steve Lufer repertoire, I think, had been in abeyance to a certain extent through their life in London, because when they were in London, although everybody knows about the London pub scene that burgeoned in the 1960s with Bobby Casey and Michael Gorman and people playing, the Cliffords weren't really a big part of that. Their life and their musical life in London was largely playing for dancers and a real mixture of styles of dancing. So, for instance, way back, John Clifford, who had played the diatonic accordion, gave that up and had a piano accordion because they were playing for quick steps and things like that. So they had a huge repertoire of dance music outside the traditional repertoire. And also there were very few Kerry and Cork people around to play with in London. I mean, they were backwards and forwards to Kerry throughout their lives, so they never lost touch with that. But in London, the music was much more eclectic, really. And she played with Bobby Casey and Lucy Farr and people like that. So had a huge repertoire of more well-known reels, lots of reels and hornpipes as well.
That was the voice of Katie Howson, an English musician who knew Julia in her later years in Thetford. And as she said, Julia and John had very busy lives in London playing in the dance halls, but their connection with home remained solid. And in the 1950s, they moved back to Ireland. Julia's son, Billy Clifford, told me how that move came about.
Between the end of the war and, say, 49, maybe, 48, 49, I wouldn't say that they came back to Ireland very much. Well, I suppose one of the obvious reasons would be the expense of it, you know. Because money was really, you know, can imagine now how tight money was in those days, you know. Like there was ration books and everything. Like it was really, you know, quite tight, very tight in those days. It wasn't until the 50s that we used to come back. There was just two of us in the family, myself and John, my brother. And we used to come back then during the 50s, which I mostly remembered, you know, as a child. Like,
and would you come back to Kerry?
I was back to Kerry, to my mother's parents' place, you know.
What was it like that, like, as a young London child coming back to Kerry?
Well, I was absolutely enthralled with it, like, you know, it was, and of course, my brother, of course, he loved it as well, needless to say, like, we loved it, you know.
And apart from those holidays then, later on in the 50s, they decided to move back to Ireland. What caused that move, or were they intending to stay forever then?
So, no, what happened then was there was a family split up then. The year of the coronation of the Queen, I think, it could have been 52 or 53, four of us came back on holiday, and Dennis Murphy, who was living at home at the time, he had to go back to, he had been living in America, as a lot of people know, and he had to go back there to claim his social security, as they used to call it. So then my grandmother was there. My mother's father had died in 1947. So my grandmother, they used to call her Manny, her name is Mary, but they used to call her Manny. She was by herself then there, and they had decided as a family that maybe I should stay with her for a couple of years. So they left me with her then from 52 to about 54.
How old were you then?
I would have been, say, nine at the time.
you were happy with that?
Oh, quite happy. Quite happy. Let them out. Off you go. I'll stay here. Yeah, that was it, yeah. So that was it then.
So you spent 2 years then with your granny?
With my granny. In a pure, like what you see out of, you know, like 100 years ago, there's a small thatched little farmhouse with a gable into the road, like, you know, three rooms all in a row, you know. And the kitchen being the front place with the half door and thatched and real basic stuff, no electricity, running water, no toilet.
And you went to school and everything?
Went to school in Guineaguilla, yeah. 2 years there.
And when did the other three then, your parents and your brother, move back?
They moved back then around 55, I'd say. Yeah, 55.
And where did they go?
And they got a accommodation in Newcastle West, County Limerick. So I rejoined him then there, and I continued my primary education there with my brother in the national school in Newcastle West. And I went on, changed up to the secondary school then. And John was a year older than me, and that brought us that. We went to their school there up to 1959. And we were on the move again then, the end of 59, all back to London again.
And was the move back to London because of?
For employment, for trying to get a job. So I would have been 16, yeah, going back to London. John would have been 17, so. We all got jobs, and we got into London then in 1959, the summer of 59 actually.
And as a 16-year-old, having kind of grown up in Ireland, how did you feel then about going back to London that time?
Hated the idea of it. But there was no choice.
And your mother the same? Or?
We were all in the same boat. Yep, all in the same boat.
That was a tough decision then.
It was a tough decision.
The time in Limerick and in Newcastle West, there was... There was a lot of music played at that time.
There was. It was an interesting time too. And my parents used to teach music there. My mother taught the fiddle, my father taught the bottom key accordion. And we used to have some pupils coming in, you know, as you would, time to time. And yeah, it was very interesting. We used to have visiting musicians then. The one that sticks out mostly is Seamus Innes. People are just knocking the door next to you. A musician with a bag of pipes in his hand, or a fiddle maybe, or an accordion, you know. Incredible, yeah.
That'll be that for the day then.
That'll be it then. Forget about the rest of the day, just launch into music and that's it.
We came to Newcastle West then. For a break, and John had his own band there, a wonderful band too. We had a family with us, just another family, the Maloneys from Devon Road, and they were wonderful musicians. We had them with us, but when Len came, then you were out of pocket, so you had no money, so we broke up. When the boys wanted jobs, we decided we'd all go back together. So we're back to London again. Played away over there then.
The band Julia talked about there was called the Star of Munster Cayley Band, and they were very popular. They played regularly in Clare and Galway and Limerick and Kerry, and they broadcast twice for Radio Éireann in Dublin. But as Julia said, the work was too seasonal and sporadic, I suppose, to make a living from it. The Star of Munster name stayed on though, and Billy, Julia and John later became the Star of Munster Trio, fiddle, flute and accordion.
We were called the Star of Munster Trio. I suppose it was based on account of the Topic Records came on board, and they wanted to record us as a family of musicians. So I think my father, I was thinking of ideas. So I said, just decide we'll call ourselves the Star of Munster Trio, and that was it. And then the record company decided it was a good idea, and they recorded us. And the LP is there on that one.
Did you do many gigs together as the trio?
Not really, not well. We didn't. No, we didn't sort of go out to take the world on as the Star Monster
Trio.
You
didn't do the launch circuit.
We didn't do the launch circuit. No, no. We just appeared in the pub as three instruments, and that was it. That was it then. Into the 60s, of course, then there was an influx of some of the great musicians from this country, the likes of Bobby Casey, you know, and Roger Sherlock, Paddy Taylor from West Limerick, some of these great musicians, to mention just a few. And they would have been from all over Ireland, Galway, Clare, Donegal. I remember Danny Meehan coming into the house one day, you know, all these. Well, let's say probably 3 weeks wouldn't go by, but you'd have somebody coming into the house.
If you go and Google Julia Clifford now, you'll find a series of photographs of her holding an instrument that looks just like a fiddle, except that it has a huge horn attached to it, and that's the Stroh fiddle. Julia loved this instrument, and it has been beautifully restored by her son, Billy. But I'm going to leave it to Matt Cranich to explain how it works.
A Stroh fiddle is sometimes referred to as a phono fiddle. Instead of a solid body like a normal fiddle, it's like a stick on which there are strings and a bridge, and attached to the bridge is like a horn, like you might have on the, you know, the picture of his master's voice photograph, something like that. And there was usually a smaller one as well, which was pointed towards the player's ear so that the player could hear this thing. And the horn then amplified the sound out to the front. And she herself, I would have said, that it was easier to play, it responded more quickly, and that it projected the music better.
I was playing in a Holloway Road, the Brewery chap, right. And this fellow Jimmy Dundee came in and he said to me, "We'll try this fiddle, Julia." He was an offerman for the beer, and he used to get broke, so I tried the fiddle, and there's a microphone there, and the governor said to me, "Julia, that fiddle does something for you." So anyway, he went away. And he came back after a fortnight and he says to me, "Will you buy it?" So I says, "Depends what you want for it." So I said, £10. So I gave him £10 for the fiddle, and that's where I got the fiddle from. Yeah. And I've been playing it ever since.
Ever since.
And it's drew a lot of attention to be with people.
Yeah. That.
I like that because it's easy to play it. Mm. Every note answers in it.
Yeah.
Every note answers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a very nice sound, isn't it? It's very warm.
Yeah, right, yeah, nice clear sound. Yeah.
Because I think for some reason I thought when it would be louder that it might be harsher or something,
no,
but it's not.
Not at all, no. It's a very kind of a defined sound.
Very clear.
Clear, very clear sound, yeah.
I can see now why she would have liked it. Yeah, it makes sense to me now.
Yeah. I think for me it was the feeling of it in my hands, and that feeling that Julia herself had, that this is what she had experienced when she was holding this instrument in her hands. I never met Julia, so for me the opportunity to play her fiddle was very special, because it was, as I suppose, as physically close to her as I'll ever get, you know.
Geraldine O'Callaghan there, a fiddle player from Fremantle in Cork. Geraldine and fiddle player Aoife O'Keefe are two of a younger generation of Sliabh Luachra musicians who've been influenced by Julia Clifford.
No, I was never fortunate enough to have met her. So I suppose her influence on me, I liked the way she went about playing the tunes that she selected. I think there's a great mystery to her playing, and Her sound is very unique. Like you'd know it was her if you were listening. I remember going to Knocknagree with Paudy to Dan Connell's, and Johnny Leary was great for telling you where the tunes would have come from. And he'd always play one. If he didn't have it, he'd always play it at the end of the night again for you. And he'd tell you where it was from. And I just remember the ones he attributed to Julia would always stand out, especially the polkas. So I think she had a great ability to play polkas at a kind of a slow, relaxed pace. But yet they'd be full of life and rhythm. They didn't need to be mad fast. You know, she had a great lift to her playing. There was, I just remember particularly one tune that Julia recorded, Johnny Cope, and that is also still one of my favourite tunes that Julia recorded. So
it's a big tune for a child to learn.
Yeah, it's a big tune, and I remember being fascinated at whatever, 12, 13, whatever age. I remember it, loving the fact that it was a six-part tune. It was a big tune, and I also loved that you could just play it on its own. You didn't have to think of anything to go with it. And I think that it was so full of mystery, it really grabbed my attention. I love playing the tune. It's a great tune.
In the 1970s, Julia and John left London and they moved to a town called Thetford in Norfolk, and that's where Julia lived until her death in 1997.
Yeah, well, what happened there was that during the 60s in London, towards the end of the 60s, there was a scheme on that they would get more elderly people to move out from the city centre, kind of thing. So my parents availed of that. They got a house in a place called Thetford in Norfolk. So they moved out there in 1970, probably 76 or 77, I think. There's a kind of, in that particular part, I'm probably still around there too, there's a folk music society there, you know. So you met a lot of people through, they used to call to the house there, you know, just to call it, they got to know that she was there, and they deliberately called to the house.
Katie, little is known, a lot is known about Julia Clifford in terms of her brother, in terms of Sliabh Luachra, in terms of her connection with Paudy O'Keefe. But there's less known about her life in England, especially after, say, the death of her husband John, say, in early 1981 or 1981. So could you fill me in? What was she playing a lot of music at that point?
She was. In fact, I think she really had a bit of a new lease of life. It's a bit of a cliche to say that, but I think it is true. That, you know, with such a life-changing event happening, her life did change quite a bit, in for the positive, actually, as well, because she found a lot of friends who took her out in the car to various places. There's a lovely little quote from her somewhere. I think it was when she wrote in her own words in the Sliabh Luachra Journal in 1987, and she said, "There's lots of music over here. You do have to travel for it." And, you know, sometimes it was 30 miles because where she lived was in rural Norfolk when they moved out from London. Well, they lived in Thetford, which is not, it's a market town and a fairly modern town, really. So she wasn't living in the depths of the countryside, but there was certainly no Irish, no community of Irish people or Irish music around there at all. And so she found a whole new community of friends through the English folk scene, really, and would travel regularly to music sessions in Norwich and Cambridge, which would be sort of 30, 40 miles from where she lived, and into little country pubs and all sorts of places, anywhere where there was some music. So they weren't all gigs, just sessions, but there were gigs as well. I think by that time, they moved up within 6 months or a year of the topic albums being out. There was the series of music from Sliabh Luachra, which Julia featured on three of those albums. So she was, you can't say she was well known, she was known for the Sliabh Luachra repertoire by then. So I think when she moved up to Norfolk, people may not have played that music, but they knew about it. And so quite a number of people did learn from her in a very informal way. She never gave lessons at all. But in a pub session, it would be a mixture, and she would lead off with reels or hornpipes from, you know, the general repertoire as much as she would her own local music from her home.
And she wasn't shy about playing gigs or anything like that?
No, and the strange thing is, you know, looking at it in a lot of detail over the last couple of years, I've watched a lot of YouTube videos and things, and there's a lovely clip of her playing at the Dublin Concert Hall. I think it was a Seán Arida retrospective. And she looks just the same playing up there on that stage for hundreds of people as she would in a session. So, no, she wasn't shy, and not backwards in coming forwards, as we say in England.
Did I read somewhere that she described gigs and things as engagements?
That's right, yes, an engagement, that's her term for it, yes. But, I mean, so that was always useful, because I don't think she had a lot of money in her later life. She'd have been on a, you know, just on a pension. So it was sociable, and the, you know, a little bit of income as well, I think, was always very welcome. And certainly one of the friends in England, Nigel Towers, who now lives out on Sherkin Island, he used to take her over to Kerry in a 2CV, actually, quite regularly. And he recalls them busking in Kenmare to get some money for lunch. So, you know, it would say the income must have been quite useful as well.
She obviously got a kick out of it as well. She obviously loved it.
Oh, she did. She absolutely loved her music. I think it was the most important thing in her life, without a doubt. And that's, I mean, that's true of many musicians, but I think it's interesting. There's not that many women who are able to devote so much of their life to music as Julia was able to, really.
I recall in the early 80s, and in fact even before that, in the 70s, meeting John and Julia Clifford at folk festivals in England, and initially John, but subsequently Julia on her own when John had passed away, meeting Julia at those festivals. And as time went on, it seemed to me that Julia became the darling, if I can put it like that, of the English folk scene. She was to be heard playing at folk clubs and at folk events of various kinds, including the large festivals that I mentioned earlier. So this was almost a new life and a new kind of life for Julia.
She got bookings in English folk clubs in her local region, in Norfolk, Suffolk, Cambridge and Essex, which is East Anglia region, right over in the east of England, and in London. And I don't see much evidence at the moment of her going much further afield than that. But she was known, and certainly as regards folk festivals, she was a regular at the National Folk Festival, which was an amazing event.
And I mean, we have a poster from one in the Waveney Valley. And at the bottom of the poster is Blows a Bella, who people might know as a world music band, were actually really very well known. And then second on the bill is Nick Jones, who's sort of a very well known singer, guitar player. And top of the bill is Julia Clifford.
That's great.
It is.
What year is that poster from?
1982. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, she was taken all over the place, and anywhere where she had a chance to play, she'd go. And there was a series of furs, and they were basically hippie furs. They were sort of, you know, sort of place you wouldn't expect to find a traditional musician playing at. But she absolutely loved them. And we've got photographs. Actually, there's a photograph of her and John. So John actually went to some as well, sitting on a farm wagon on a bale of straw, surrounded by a hippie crowd and all lapping it up.
They absolutely loved her over there. Yeah, they really did. Now, I was gobsmacked with that recent thing that went on there over in Stowmarket. It was over a weekend. And the tributes that were paid to her was completely bowled over by it. When you see people going up on the stage and they're talking about your own, my mother, like, just, you know, it's quite, you know, it's just a very moving thing for me, like, do you know?
Thank you.
Throughout her life, Julia played alongside many brilliant male musicians, and then she also had a fantastic solo musical career later on in life. But when she died in 1997, her obituary in The Guardian newspaper suggested that her opportunities as a musician may have been restricted by her role or by her responsibilities as a woman, as a wife, and as a mother. Fiddle player Geraldine O'Callaghan has been looking into issues of gender in music, and I asked her about this.
It's a very interesting question. She herself, when she was interviewed by Reg Hall about her time in London, she said that there was no difficulty in going out playing in the pubs, and that she felt no difficulty, that it wasn't, her gender wasn't an issue or it wasn't a barrier to her accessing the music scene in London. But the reality is, Julia, until Julia was married, she wasn't really performing in public on the London scene. So her professional music career was always either alongside her husband, John, or her son, Billy, or her brother, Dennis, or her tutor, Padraig. So she was always performing alongside of a male counterpart, which kind of legitimised her public performance, you know. Like, the reality is, at that time for women at home in Ireland, you're talking about a time where the civil liberties of women were largely ignored. It was a very difficult time to be female. And it was very difficult for Julia, being a woman, as an immigrant abroad in London. She was, at various points, she was working, she was later married, she was a mother, she was also a musician, and she was, as Billy described her, she was the gel that held everything together, you know. So she had all of these important roles to play, and it was actually only in her senior years that she actually really had an opportunity to be a solo performer, to actually be really fully appreciated just on her own.
While being a woman in the 20th century had its own challenges, it's also interesting to remember that the music of Sliabh Luachra wouldn't have been as widely known or as popular as it is today. Seamus Ennis did record Dennis Murphy, Julia Clifford and Padraig O'Keefe on what was to become a legendary night in September 1952. But that recording, or that album, wasn't widely available until much, much later.
In addition to Julia's role as a homemaker and children to rear and so on, also the style of music that they played was not the kind of mainstream, what would have been considered mainstream Irish music, in the sense of it emanating from the, let's say, the Sligo tradition, or at the time, I gather, in London, there was a lot of accordion players from the Connemara box-playing tradition. So John and Julia didn't kind of fit into that. So their music didn't, I suppose, accord greatly with the what might be considered the mainstream music. It was a minority music. And that, coupled with Julia's own, I suppose, life and expectations of what was expected of her, meant that they didn't hit the top of the scale, so to speak. On the other hand, I think when Julia went to Norwich, up to Thetford, and particularly when John had passed away, Julia came into her own in a different milieu. On the one hand, as I said, she was embraced by the folk music community, and on the other hand, she was coming back here to Ireland to play at concerts and events, maybe a lot more frequently than she had done before that. So maybe that Julia's day came at that stage. Indeed, I remember two great concerts, one in Kenmare, one in Cork, where the fiddle concert featured both Julia Clifford and Sean Maguire. Imagine that lineup, the same concert, and both were received equally well.
One of the people she first met when she moved to Thetford was a guy called Jonathan Reynolds, and he wrote to me with some memories of her, and he said when he first knew her, when she and John had just moved there, and John was in very poor health at that time. And he remembers taking them up to Norwich and various things. And he says he passed back through Thetford several years later, and he was absolutely amazed to see Julia standing at the bus stop with her fiddle to go into Norwich, because he'd never seen her be so independent before. I think it must have been a great period in her life.
She was a great mother. Like, she was, she wasn't a bit strict. My father wasn't strict either, to be honest about it. Any of the two of them weren't what you call really strict. We didn't need that much. I warned you, there's a funny word, but we didn't have to be chastised, as the fellas say. Do you know that? But they were great, and there were problems. Every family has problems. I'm not going to try cover it all up. There were problems, but on the whole, looking back at it, as you know, I could honestly say that we were privileged in a way that we had such good parents. Do you understand? That would be the bottom line, as far as I'd be concerned, anyhow. Do you know?
Yet one time I was having dinner with two gents of Linehan's of Knocknabowl, and Padraig and Dintan were playing for sets, and we went in the yard and the door was opened, and you could hear the set, the polkas out. Well, I thought it was the nicest thing I ever had, was the polkas that he played coming through the door, and we going in, myself and just. But I never forget that.
Thanks for listening to the Rolling Wave podcast. For rights reasons, the music here is shorter than in the original broadcasts. So if you want to hear the full versions, just go to rte.ie/radio1. This programme was first broadcast on the 3rd of May 2020. Till the next time, Gura Míle Maggie, agus slán.